Let's start with another short meditation. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, let go of any external distractions and allow your awareness to descend into your body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Use the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. In this way, allowing your entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And if you find it helpful, you can take 3 slow, deep breaths. Maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. Then allow your breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allowing the breath to flow naturally, effortlessly. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. without dwelling in the past, without anticipating the future. Simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body, Now narrow the focus and simply focus on the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. And again, without trying to force or regulate the breath, simply allow the breathing to flow naturally. And keeping all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. And use the rope of mindfulness to tie your mind to the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. where is this mind that is focusing on the breath? Where is it located? Can the mind be found anywhere? Is the mind inside the body? Is the mind located somewhere inside the head? Is it somewhere behind the eyes? Is it located at the place where the sensations of the breath are occurring? Is the mind outside the body? Is it in front of the body? Is it above the body? Is it behind the body? Does the mind have a particular color? Does the mind have a particular shape? Does the mind have any identifiable characteristics at all? How big is the mind? Does it have a particular size? Is it fitting inside the head? Or is it big like the sky? Does the mind have a center? Does it have a physical limit or boundary? and then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Without doing anything at all, without even trying to meditate, just be. Just rest in luminously clear awareness. Relaxed and alert. Open and spacious. And maintaining that open, spacious state, we can slowly finish this meditation and begin our discussions together today. So again, let's begin with a short review of what we've covered so far, so we have that clear in our mind. So we're following this text, the 7-point mind training. Which belongs to the Lojong system of practice. It's a system of practice that was introduced into Tibet through mainly the great Indian master Lama Atisha. And like all systems of practice in Buddhism, the two core practices, the two main practices are wisdom and compassion. And since this is belonging to the Mahayana tradition, the Mahayana vehicle, then the wisdom side of the practice is this wisdom of emptiness. The fact that everything is empty of independent existence. There is no independent me, no independent objective world out there. And the compassion side of the practice is the bodhicitta motivation. And remember here in the Lojong system approach to bodhicitta, We are using the method of exchanging self with others to develop bodhicitta. This is often called the secret method, because it was not really taught very much publicly in ancient India and Tibet, because it was considered too difficult for the average person to implement. Rather, the seven cause and effect method was the public teaching. But I think in our modern society, this approach of exchanging self with others has enormous benefits. So I think this Lojong approach to the bodhicitta, I think, is very much suitable to our modern society. And also, another strength of the Lojong approach to wisdom and compassion is that it gives us very practical advice on how to transform adverse conditions into the spiritual path, how to see difficult situations in our life not as problems or obstacles, but as opportunities for spiritual growth. So I think this is also another very good reason why the Lojong approach to spiritual path can be very useful in our modern society. And we are following the commentary on this seven-point mind training from Ser Chilbu Cheki Gelsen, who is one of the main disciples of Geshe Chikawa. So this was around, of course, the 12th century. And so far in the text, we've covered the first of the 7 points. So remember, these 57 slogans or short statements that we're looking at is coming from Lama Atisha, but this was systematized into these 7 points by Geshe Chikawa. So hence it's often said Geshe Chikawa is the author of the 7-point mind training. And so we've covered the first of the 7 points, which is the training in the preliminaries, the foundation, the basis. So we saw there that it's important, as with every practice, every system of practice of wisdom and compassion, that we need to have a solid foundation for practice. Otherwise, we're going to be very lazy when it comes to practice. We're going to be constantly distracted by a lot of meaningless mundane activities that are not really important in our life. And we're not going to have a very good motivation for engaging in spiritual practice. So if we have that solid foundation, then we will find that a lot of time and space will open up in our lives to devote to meditation, more meaningful activities. And we will have a very strong motivation to make our life meaningful, to really want to develop ourselves as a person, and to really search within ourselves for the source of happiness and the source of suffering, rather than looking for happiness out there or blaming things and people out there as the source of our problems and suffering. And so then we began to look at the second point of the 7-point mind training, which is where we currently are. And the second of the seven points, of course, is training in the two minds of awakening, or the two bodhicittas, the main practice. And again, the two bodhicittas is conventional bodhicitta, which is the compassionate mind of bodhicitta, and ultimate bodhicitta, which is the wisdom of emptiness. And so these are the two practices we're now looking at, and we're looking at the first of those two, which is ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom of emptiness. And as with every practice, for any practice to be effective, there are two parts to the practice. There is the meditation practice, and then what we do subsequent to meditation, meaning what we do for the rest of the day. So if any practice is to be effective and progress, we need to also integrate our meditation practice into daily life. So there, of course, then is instructions, advice and guidance about how to do the meditation and what to do in daily life. And currently we're looking at the first of those two, the meditation practice. And so within the meditation practice, we already had a look at how to prepare ourselves well at the beginning of a meditation. And we also saw that for any meditation to be effective, we need to have a very stable, clear mind. We need to be developing that stability and clarity through the shamatha practice. So particularly as a beginner, we need to put a lot of emphasis in our shamatha practice to really develop a very stable and clear mind, focused mind. If we don't, then of course we can put a lot of effort into the wisdom and compassion practices and other practices and not really receive much benefit because our mind is constantly dull and distracted. So we looked briefly yesterday then at the shamatha practice and how to really work on developing that stable and clear mind. And then we started to look at the actual meditation of the ultimate bodhicitta, the emptiness practice. And there we were looking at the first of the four slogans related to this practice. And it was on page 91. At the top where it said, next, the initial meditation on the absence of intrinsic existence of perceived objects is presented in the following line. Train to view all phenomena as dreamlike. So this statement, absence of intrinsic existence, is emptiness. So emptiness is the fact that everything lacks intrinsic existence, or everything is empty of intrinsic or inherent existence, or everything is empty of independent existence. So this is what emptiness, or in Sanskrit, shunyata, means. So emptiness does not mean nothing really exists. Emptiness is saying nothing exists independently. And the first part of that investigation here is to investigate perceived objects, meaning the phenomenal world that we perceive, and to train to view them as dreamlike. So what that means, of course, is that when we look out on this external world, everything appears to us to exist completely independent of us. There appears to be an objective, independent world there, made up of many separate, discrete objects. But as the commentary for this point is saying, is that when we investigate these appearances, we'll come to see that there's not even a single atom that exists as a reality separate from the mind. That things are, as the commentary says, things are mere appearances. What does that mean? What does it mean for things to be mere appearances? Is, as we saw yesterday, what actually we perceive is simply a mass of sense data. And that sense data, of course, is constantly changing and flowing. And to make sense of that information that we receive, we draw lines around various collections of data and we create objects and then we give them names so that we can communicate. And we have to do this because if we don't do this, we can't make any sense or meaning of anything. We wouldn't be able to function. So that's what it means for things to be mere appearances. It means things are merely labeled. It means we are creating this world by drawing lines and giving names. But the problem is that we don't realize that's what we're doing. Because it appears to us as if the world is already made up of many separate, discrete things. And so what we do is we turn our lines into hard boundaries. We see the world as already divided up into many separate discrete things. And as we saw yesterday, if we see the world in this way, that the world is made up of many separate, individual, discrete things, then actually things become very illogical. We looked at the example of the seed producing the sprout, and we saw that, you know, if there really is a single thing which is a seed there producing a single thing which is a plant there, then we looked at, you know, does the seed cease before the plant comes into existence, yes or no? And we saw that actually both answers of yes and no are illogical, meaning that our idea of cause and effect is actually completely illogical if we are believing that the world is made up of many separate discrete things. It actually becomes illogical. In the same way, our idea of agent and action, fire and fuel, all of these relationships that exist become illogical. And then we can also sort of ask the question, though, you know, well, apart from that, I mean, what is really the problem with seeing the world as already divided up into many separate discrete things? What's the big deal with that, seeing the world in that way? And we saw that actually this is the root cause of all of our suffering. And we saw that in that chart yesterday, that suffering and its causes chart. Because if we believe that the world is made up of many separate discrete things independent of us, then of course when we interact with this world, and for example we experience a particular object and we have a pleasant experience, then that pleasant experience, together with the belief that there is that single object there independent of us, will naturally lead us to assume that there must be some attractive quality in that object that's causing my pleasant experience. So we're going to see that object as inherently attractive. And then, of course, I like pleasant experiences. I want pleasant experiences. That object seems to be causing my pleasant experience. I want that object. That is attachment. Or if we have an unpleasant experience, we'll naturally assume there must be some unattractive quality in the object that's causing my unpleasant experience. I don't want unpleasant experiences. That object seems to be causing my unpleasant experience. Get it out of here. Aversion. So we can see that this belief in a separate, independent reality made up of many discrete objects leads to attachment and aversion from our pleasant and unpleasant experiences. And if we look at this, we can also understand that all of our other mental afflictions, such as jealousy and craving, fear, anxiety, depression, all of these other mental afflictions come out of either attachment, aversion, or a combination of them. So we can see that all of our mental afflictions are coming from this mistaken view of reality, believing that there is a world out there, independent of us, made up of many separate, discrete things. And then, of course, those mental afflictions are driving our behavior, and we end up with a lot of suffering as a result of that. So what this statement is saying is to train to view all phenomena as dreamlike. So how is all phenomena like a dream? Notice the statement is not saying all phenomena are dreams. Because if we think like that, we may think, well, dreams don't really exist, so therefore none of these things really exist. The statement is saying things are like a dream. So how are these things like a dream? As we saw yesterday, in a dream, there really does appear to be an independent, objective dream world out there when we're in the middle of the dream. But if we become lucid in the dream or we wake up from the dream, we'll realize that that dream world is not existing as it appears. Even though there appears to be an independent, objective dream world there, we will of course realize that it's a product of our mind, that it's not independent, objective dream world. Likewise, in our waking world, We now, this world appears to us to exist completely independent of us, and like a dream, we accept those appearances and we react to pleasant and unpleasant experiences with attachment and aversion, have a lot of suffering. But if we wake up from our ignorance, if we become lucid in our waking state by realizing emptiness, we will also realize that these appearances are deceiving us. They do not exist in the way they appear. There is no independent objective world there. This world is also a product of our mind. This world exists within our conceptual framework. And then we will understand that all phenomena are dreamlike. So that's what we were looking at yesterday. So what I'd like to... Oh, just one more point on that. So how are we to investigate this world then? Is that we can investigate the individual objects, as it's suggested here. Before that point, at the top of page 91, it says that we are to relate to these phenomena in a gradual manner, enumerating each phenomena by means of the pristine cognition of discriminative awareness. Meaning, our discriminative awareness is that we are to investigate individually these objects and to see how they exist. Because things really do appear to exist independent of us. So if they really do exist independent of us, they must be findable there. So we can use our discriminative awareness to investigate these objects. For example, this cup. There really does seem to be a cup there independent of us. So is there a cup to be found here amongst this basis anywhere? And so then we can investigate, as we did with the pen yesterday, where is the cup there amongst that basis, you know? Is this a cup? Is this curved thing a cup? Is this round thing a cup? Is the flat thing a cup? And we can look everywhere here, and we will not find a cup there from its own side. And that not finding the object amongst the basis is a realization of emptiness. And when we don't find that not finding, we hold that experience as long as we can. And I'm going to talk more about this practice based on the next statement. But just to briefly mention it now. And so we can understand then that this cup, like all the perceived objects, is dreamlike. That there is no cup existing separate from the mind. That the cup is a mere appearance. That the cup is something merely labeled by our mind on the basis of this collection of stuff. And so this is what we can understand, that there is, that this cup, like all phenomena, is dreamlike. Of course, dreamlike doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It means it does not exist in the way it appears to us. And so that is a realization of emptiness, that there is no independent objective cup to be found there amongst the basis. So to continue on with our discussion of emptiness, we'll move now to the next slogan, where it says, next, the meditation on the absence of the intrinsic existence of perceiving subjects is presented in the following line. Examine the nature of the unborn awareness. So before we go into that slogan and the commentary that follows, I'd just like to add a little bit more. So, remember yesterday then we said that to make sense of this world, we have to draw these lines and give names, create objects to make meaning. But generally, in every one of our experiences, the very first line we draw is we draw a line around here, and we conceptually isolate the experiencer. Because In every experience, there's single experience. Within single experience, there are two aspects. There's experiencer and experienced, or here, perceiving subject, perceived object, or subject, object. And we have to identify the perceiving subject, because if we don't, we can't make any sense at all. So we have to draw a line and give the label me, subject, whatever the label happens to be. But like objects, we don't realize that's what we're doing. We believe there is already an independent perceiving subject, an independent me here. So again, what we do is we turn this line that we draw into a boundary. We contract around the me part of the experience and believe that there is already an independent me here observing this supposed independent world. And so this grasping onto this belief that there's me, which is actually just a mere appearance, it's merely labeled like the objects, but we contract around that and believe there's an independent me here to begin with. This is called self-grasping, the self-grasping mind. But this belief is completely illogical. Just like the example of the seed and the sprout, believing there's a separate seed and a separate plant, that is illogical, we saw from that example. Similarly, this self-grasping mind, which is the basis of all of our behavior, is completely illogical. And to really highlight that, then we can use a very simple example. Is this big? Yes. So big cannot exist on its own. You cannot have big on its own. You can only have big, you know, relative to small. So big can only exist relationship to small. You cannot have big and that is not small. They only exist dependently, mutually dependent. Like that, of course, you can only have up if there's down, in if there's out. In the same way, you can only have me if there's not me. You can only have subject if there's object. You can only have experiencer if there's experienced. But what we do, of course, is we grasp on to the me part of the experience, and we believe there's an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. That's exactly like saying this is big. It just does not make any sense whatsoever. Big cannot exist in isolation. You cannot have me in isolation. It's just illogical. But this, of course, intellectually we can sort of maybe appreciate that. But again, our behavior is based on our instinctive habit. And what we instinctively do, of course, is we grasp onto this me part of the experience and we see ourselves as existing independent of the experienced, the world. And so this self-grasping mind then is the source of all of our suffering. Because by grasping onto independent me, we are therefore grasping onto independent objective world, and as we just saw, when we do that, when we have pleasant, unpleasant experiences, that leads to attachment, aversion, a whole big mess. And particularly with this self-grasping mind, if we have this strong self-grasping, and generally we often do in our behavior, we always tend to behave in terms of me, going there, me saying this, me, 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 me. And then, of course, with this self-grasping, then comes the other state of mind called self-cherishing. When we become grasping onto this self, then we on top of that, then we grasp onto the fact that this me here is the most important thing in the world. My happiness is the most important thing. The world revolves around me. And we tend to see everything from this very narrow perspective. How is this situation affecting me and my happiness? This is coming from self-grasping. And so we tend to get very obsessed about me and my happiness, me and my suffering. And then because of that grasping, we are believing that there is an independent objective world out there, which then, of course, appears to be the source of our happiness and suffering. And so if we have this strong self-grasping, then often we develop a lot of fear and anxiety about the world, because everything out there is a potential threat to my happiness. I have to be on guard all the time. So things become very stressful. We become very sensitive to what other people say about us. And of course, then to protect ourselves from the supposed danger out there, we build a big wall around ourselves to protect ourselves. Then we cut ourselves off from the world. We become very isolated and lonely. And then, of course, because we see, it seems like the source of our happiness is coming from out there, and we're obsessed about me and my happiness, we often develop a lot of craving and attachment for things and pleasures. And then, of course, if we don't manage to get those things that seem to be the source of our happiness, we have a lot of frustration in our life. Even if we get the things that seem to be the source of our happiness, they never really fully satisfy us. We simply end up craving for more. So it's insatiable craving. More, 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 more. And then, of course, when nothing is really satisfying us, we often have a lot of dissatisfaction, disappointment, and even sometimes come completely depressed because nothing is satisfying me. There's no happiness that's really, we can't find this happiness. So this is coming from this self-grasping mind. And what's happening, of course, is when we grasp onto the me part of the experience, we see ourselves as independent of the experienced. But again, this is completely illogical, just like this is not big. Big only exists dependent on small. The experiencer only exists dependent on the experience. But experientially, that's not how we see it. We see definitely there's a me here, independent, and there's an independent objective world there. And that's how we behave. And we have this self-grasping mind, and in our behavior, it's always me going there, me saying this, me doing that. It's always me, 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 me. The more we have this self-grasping, the more we are out of sync with reality, this interdependent nature of reality. The more we are out of sync with that, the more we fight against reality. The more we do that, the more we suffer, and the more mental afflictions we generate, the more suffering, and the more that people around us suffer as well. But sometimes in our behavior, we don't have such strong self-grasping. We're not so out of sync with reality. And this, and I think I briefly mentioned this already earlier, is sometimes in our behavior, we can sometimes be more focused on the activity rather than the me doing the activity, particularly when we have high level of focus on our action. Then we're more focused on the activity rather than the agent, the me who's doing it. So in those occasions, the self-grasping is a little bit less. And this we've experienced many times, you know, when we're like absorbed in reading a book, we're absorbed in watching an interesting program on TV. We're absorbed in solving a problem at work. In those occasions, due to our focus on the activity, there's less grasping onto the me. And we know from our own experience in those occasions, time seems to go quite quickly, things seem to flow quite well. Why? Because we're not fighting so much against reality through the self-grasping mind. And this is very much amplified in people who have developed a high level of focus in their activity. For example, professional musicians, professional athletes who've spent thousands of hours of training in their activity and have developed a high level of focus in their activity. And then often when they're engaged in that activity, because of that high level of focus, they often report that they're in the zone or the flow state. And often then they report that, well, you know, there was no sense of a me. There was just the music playing. There was just the activity happening. And of course, what's happening there is that due to their high level of focus on the activity, the self-grasping is very, very much reduced. And they also report peak performance, optimum performance in this state. Why? Because they're not fighting against reality. They're more in harmony with the interconnected nature of reality. That's why they have peak performance, optimum performance. But that's only due to the power of concentration. It's not because they realize the interconnected nature of reality. So, of course, it's very helpful to have that level of focus. So, again, the shamatha practice can actually help in our daily life activities in that way. By having that better focus, it can, as a byproduct of that, it can help reduce the self-grasping mind a little bit. But of course, we need to do more than that. We need to eliminate self-grasping by realizing that there is no independent me here to begin with. That's the wisdom practice. That's the emptiness practice. And so by realizing emptiness, realizing there's no independent me here, no independent objective world out there, we will realize that the me is also a mere appearance, something merely labeled, that the me is a dependent phenomena. We will realize there is no boundary here. There's not, in fact, a single boundary in the entire universe. There's just a continuous flow of change in the entire universe. And by realizing there's no boundary between us and others, then we'll be able to fully develop love and compassion for others. Because now, as long as we feel like there's a me here and a them there, it's difficult to fully develop love and compassion because we feel like there's some sort of gap or distance between us and others, some separateness. But by realizing emptiness, we'll realize there's no separateness. But does that mean we all become one? No. You know, often we hear, oh, everything's one. Actually, this is not technically correct. Again, is this big? So big only exists dependent on small. Now, of course, we believe in duality. There are two things. There's big and small. Experientially, that's what we believe. Intellectually, of course, we understand that's complete illogical. But experientially, we believe there are two things. There's big and there's small. But by realizing there's not big and not small, or not me and not the world, does everything become one? Because one means identical. Is big and small one? Are they identical? No. They're not two. Two means big and small. One means big and small are one, means identical, same. Of course, that's not the case. Big and small exist interdependently. And the way to say that correctly in Buddhism is things are not two or non-dualistic. You cannot say things are one. We don't all become one big blob. Yes, there's a question.
Say
sensation. You mean physical or mental?
No, you were explaining we have, you know, a range of sense data, and then we draw lines in order to conceptualize. But how do these sense data come into existence before the conceptualization?
What do you mean by the... Well, the sense data is also a dependent phenomena. So, like, you know, in the lower Buddhist philosophical schools, from based on the Four Noble Truths, then there is an objective world there, made up of these very tiny little particles, which the Buddha called kalapas, which of course is sort of equivalent to classical physics. So in classical physics, of course, there is an objective world made up of atoms and subatomic particles. And so the lower Buddhist philosophical systems, based on the Four Noble Truths, would agree with classical physics. Yes, there is an objective world out there made up of these very little tiny particles. But this view we're saying here is saying that's not true. So this view is not saying there's no atoms and subatomic particles. It's saying there's no atoms and subatomic particles existing independent of us. Because an atom and a subatomic particle is also a mere appearance, something merely labeled. Because isn't an atom a concept that we've developed to explain this data? Isn't a subatomic particle something we've developed as a human to explain appearances? So these are also concepts. So there's no bottom. There's no data there independent of us.
Yeah, but somehow it seems like you were dividing the process into different stages. So
correct.
The sense data, and then the conceptualization, which draws a line around it. But, for example, if you haven't reached the moment of conceptualization, you would have a moment of pure sensation of sense data.
Right, but that experience is still mutually dependent, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's what we're saying. But I think you're asking what is the actual physical mechanism of how that perception takes place.
Yeah.
That's of no relevance here in a discussion of how things exist. That would be more in terms of talking about the mechanism of how perception and conception works, which is a completely separate topic. That is a huge topic in Buddhism. And there are also within that, within the different philosophical systems, there are differences of opinion of how that process works. So to effectively answer this question involves a whole course on that topic.
How is this course
Well, it comes in a number of areas. I mean, some of that will be touched on in this course that Geshe Kelsang Wangmo is going to teach in June, the Four Tenet Systems. The Four Tenet Systems are these four philosophical systems which talk about the varying ideas about nature of reality. But within those tenet systems also in there, you will find some discussion about how perception works and conception works. And there are differences of opinion in the four schools about that as well. So that is a huge topic. Another area that is of interest in that is called Lo-Rig, Minds and Awarenesses. And so there also there's a lot of discussion about how this process works. So that's a whole topic in itself. So that is not really directly relevant to what we're doing here. Of course, that's an interesting topic, but that's something other than what we're discussing. Here we're talking about not really the process of perception and conception, but we're talking about how are things existing within that. But if there's a very specific question, I might try and give you a brief answer. Do you have a very specific question regarding this? Yeah. What we can sort of say in a simple way is that, of course, in classical physics, the material world is the primary thing. And then secondary is becoming aware of that. Whereas in Buddhism, it's the opposite, particularly here in this view, is that the mind is primary and that there is no independent physical world. It does not exist. So often these sorts of questions are asked is, how do we perceive this physical reality? And built in to the question is the assumption is that there is an objective physical reality there that we're trying to perceive. So if that is the assumption in the question, then we cannot answer that question because there is no independent physical reality there that we're trying to understand. That is what this view is saying. The lower Buddhist schools would say there is a physical independent reality that we're trying to understand. But here, that doesn't exist. So that is, I think, something we have to think about before we ask these sorts of questions, because otherwise it's difficult to answer them. Because built into the question is the assumption there is some sort of objective physical reality there that somehow we are perceiving or trying to understand.
It was not built in.
Okay.
It was more based on that there is no independent inherent existence, and that you were talking about process of conception, but before also there is no independent inherent existence, there is a process of sensation, and this is different from the conception. And I just was wondering how this moment of
Well, I'll give you two brief answers in the two schools that are in the Mahayana. In the Chittamatra system, it's saying that the subject and object come into existence simultaneously. That the sensation and the appearance of the object happen simultaneously. It's not that the object causes that experience. Whereas in the Majjhimika system, it's even though they're mutually dependent, there is a causal relationship between the object and the sensation. So in the Chittamatra system, the subject and object come into existence simultaneously, meaning there is no causal relationship between the appearance of the object and the experience of the object. Whereas in the Majjhimika, there is a causal relationship. Even though they are mutually dependent, there is a causal relationship between the object and the perception of the object. But again, to say more about that is a huge topic that would probably take me a couple of hours to explain. So I think it's a bit beyond the subject matter here. So again, if you want to know more about this, then the tenets that Geshe Kelsang Wangmo is talking about, I'm sure she'll touch on these points, and also the low rig system of teachings, minds and awarenesses, also touches on this topic.
My question is, the realization of emptiness can take some time through meditation and through reading and understanding a bit more. In meanwhile, when we are on this path and in this process, can we use the approach of seeing the things as a mental projection only, so that we are actually not getting trapped with the attachment, but just having a sense of realization, but not having the deep realization.
So you're obviously talking about in daily life.
Yes.
In fact, that's over the page, on page 92, down the bottom, in the intervals, be a conjurer of illusions. That is exactly the practice that we're going to look at. For that practice to be effective, of course, it would be helpful to have some meditative experience of emptiness, because otherwise it's merely some intellectual idea, which, as I said, is in our behavior. When we're in a situation that is evoking some emotional response, either attachment or aversion, usually when that comes up, our rational mind is sort of gone. Whereas if we've had some experience of emptiness in meditation, that is still driving us quite more in our daily practice. So you'll find that if we have some meditational experience on emptiness, then that will be more present at that time, that understanding. Where if it's just some merely intellectual understanding of emptiness, then we have to really have strong mindfulness to keep that in mind at all times, which is what we should try to do, but it's not going to be very easy. Whereas if we have some experiential of emptiness in meditation, that awareness of that nature of reality will be more present with us in our behavior. And it'll be easier to, particularly in those situations that normally evoke an emotional reaction, it'll be easier for us to remind ourselves that things are not as they appear.
What I was finding from my personal experience is definitely through meditation, realization is very important, but that can take a long time.
Sure, sure.
So in meanwhile, what helped me personally was seeing the things from that perspective, just the intellectual perspective.
Sure, sure.
And applying that thinking into my routine life.
Exactly.
And as you said, it's not easy, but making that as a habit, the mindfulness
exactly.
is helpful.
Exactly, and that's probably where we're going to be starting to do this. And that is the advice on the next page, is to be this conjurer of illusions, meaning to see, to understand that things are not as they appear in daily life. So the more we can do that, the more that will also, of course, feed back into our emptiness meditation. And then the more we meditate, the more it becomes easier to do that. So it's like a reinforcing cycle. So this is what we should try to do. But yes, as a beginner, if we have not got really any meditative experience of emptiness, then we still, of course, try to do this as best we can. Because that's where we start. That's where we got to start. Of course. But if we leave it there, if we think that, oh, I don't need to meditate on emptiness because I intellectually understand it and all I need to do is think about it in daily life, if we leave it there, I think we're going to have limited progress and success. I mean, it'll be a bit helpful, but we won't get very far.
It would be very easy to lose when
of course, of course. So we need to build on that.
Mm-hmm. We are not
one.
One.
Yeah.
But does it mean that we are part of this one? So what
yeah.
does that mean that we are just a small part of this big one?
But one is still dualistic thinking. One implies two.
But I mean
so,
one like
yeah, universe. Yeah, yeah. But again, one, is the universe at one thing? Is it? No. Is anything one thing? No. To use that in a good way, we can say that everything is of one nature. Everything is of one nature. And we see this sometimes in Buddhist texts. You know? We see sometimes like samsara and nirvana are of one taste. What does that mean? That everything has the one nature. Everything has the nature of emptiness. Everything is empty of independent existence. Everything is a dependent arising. So we can say everything is one nature. But to say everything's one, technically is still dualistic way of speaking. And it's actually incorrect. Because one means identical, same. How are things identical and same? Is that everything has the same nature. Everything is empty of independent existence. So you can talk about oneness in that way. Everything is oneness in terms of having the same nature. Everything is a dependent arising. So in that way we can talk about this idea. But to say that everything's one is technically incorrect, and it can lead to, I mean, because even saying that, we can then grasp onto that and saying, well, that's the real thing. That one is the one universe. That's real. So we can still grasp onto that. But again, one, you can only grasp onto one if there's not one, meaning two. So technically, you can only say things are not two, meaning not dualistic. So that's how actually in the text it says. It says things are not two. Everything has one nature or the same nature. Yes, we can say that. Okay. Yeah, then we need to go for a break. Generally, yes. I mean, so what we need to be careful of here is I'm talking about philosophical systems. The philosophical systems based on the Four Noble Truths. So it's important we need to distinguish philosophical systems and practitioners. So in the philosophical systems that are the basis of Theravada, this is the belief. If you talk to individual Theravada practitioners or you talk to individual Mahayana practitioners, they may have completely different experiences. So we need to be careful with that.
Okay, but there's one thing that you can't understand.
Sure.
Because the wisdom here in the critical thing, the wisdom from Theravada was that there is no self. We need to just
correct.
That there's no self. So that means that I'm empty of the inherent existence.
Not in the Theravada. No. No. In Theravada, and in fact in some of the lower philosophical schools in Mahayana, you do inherently exist.
Okay, it's
yes. So, in the Theravada, and also some of the lower philosophical systems in the Mahayana, they all accept there is an inherently existing person. That there is a findable person. So the no self in those philosophical systems is not saying no inherently existent self. It's no self-sufficient, substantially existent self, which I briefly looked at yesterday, was that, you know, in that philosophical system, the basis of the person, the body and the mind, exists. That the person is just something labeled on the body, which exists independently, and the mind, which exists independently. But that's not how we see ourselves. We believe that there's something more than just the body and the mind here. So the person is the basis of the body and the mind. That's the belief in that system. In this system, of course, not. But we believe there's something more than just the body and the mind here. You know, there's this me here. There's me. I have a body. I have a mind. As if there's a third thing, this me here, that has this body and has this mind. So experientially, there seems to be a me here that's a little bit more than just the body and the mind. That's the self that they refute. But still, when they refute that, there's still a very real body and mind here that you can point to and point to the me within that. But not in this, there's not a third entity in addition to the body and the mind. But that's instinctively how we see ourselves now. Intellectually, of course, it just doesn't make any sense, does it?
Yeah.
But that's not how we instinctively see ourselves. Instinctively, we do feel that there's something more than just the body and the mind here. This is me. This me that has a body, has a mind. And that's what we relate to. That is this overinflated sense of me called self that we need to get rid of. So that's not the inherently existing me. But anyway, on that note, let's take a break, morning tea break. Come back at 10:45.